everybody. Good morning. Welcome to the Panic Podcast for Monday, a brand new week. And we're going to conclude our survey of James. I thought we'd be starting our in-depth study today, but we have one more chapter in the book of James to do a quick survey of, and that's James chapter 5. So get your Bibles open up, and we'll get started in James chapter 5. Yeah, I somehow lost count of the studies. That's what happens when I've got too much going on. So we are actually in James chapter 5, as I said, and we will do our survey of that chapter right now. Practicing patience and prayer. Just give me one second here to get this microphone set. There we go. Hope you had a good weekend. Did y'all have good church services? I hope you did. We were missing a lot of people in our church yesterday. Not sure why. Well, I shouldn't say that. We had a couple of families out. They were traveling. And I guess people just sleeping in. But we used to call a pillow ministry back in the day. They were engaged in pillow ministry. I hate to break it to people, but pillow ministry is not going to do anything for your spiritual health. So if you're listening to this and you normally attend my church and you slept in yesterday, shame on you. Shame on you. Make sure you're back out next Sunday or I'll call you out again. But I hope you had a good weekend. You know, Friday was an interesting day for me. We were actually on the road Friday. Did we do a podcast on Friday? I think we did. I think I recorded it the day ahead. That's right. We went to a little town called Farmville in Virginia, very rural area. And what a beautiful place. I don't know that I'd ever been to Farmville before, but it is exactly as its name sounds. It's rural, lots of green. There's farms, saw some stables, I guess. And that was really, really nice. Maybe 4 hours from where we live here. And it was nice. And Friday was so beautiful. It was in the mid-80s. What a shock to the system when Saturday and Sunday rolled around and we were down in the mid to upper 40s and low 50s. Boy, that's just the way spring is here. We go from one extreme to another until summer finally settles in. Hopefully in the next couple of weeks it'll even out. Yep, and then our rainy season starts. Boy, can't wait for that. Well, James chapter 5. We might be encouraged, or we might be tempted to think, that with a church full of people who all claim to be committed Christians, who all claim to be committed to the way of Christ, that things would go smoothly in that church. But how wrong would you be? The truth is, we are all works in progress. Now, that's not an excuse for sloppy Christian lives, but it is an explanation. And the reason why problems and challenges frequently arise in church and why they must be addressed. James's whole letter, every single chapter, gives us great resources for not only living properly, but also how we can keep our church running properly and smoothly. Let's take a look at the value of patience and perseverance, both in your personal life, but also in the life of your church. The first six verses of James chapter 5, he addressed wealthy people who were oppressing the poor. Yeah, maybe we better read those. James chapter 5 verses, let's see, what did I say, 1 to 6. And I'll read it from the Living Bible just to give you a different flavor. "Look here, you rich man," James begins. "Now is the time to cry and groan with anguished grief because of all the terrible troubles ahead of you. Your wealth is even now rotting away, and your fine clothes are becoming mere moth-eaten rags. The value of your gold and silver is dropping fast, yet it will stand as evidence against you and eat your flesh like fire. That's what you have stored up for yourselves to receive on that coming day of judgment. For listen, hear the cries of the field workers whom you've cheated of their pay. Their cries have reached the ears of the Lord of hosts. You've spent years here on earth having fun, satisfying your every whim. And now your fat hearts are ready for the slaughter. Living Bible. You've condemned and killed good men who had no power to defend themselves against you. Wow. Wow. How about that? Now, I would hasten to say this, that not every wealthy person oppresses the poor. But apparently, there were some wealthy people who were oppressing some of the readers of this letter. And that's the problem that James is addressing. Don't misunderstand what James is saying here. This is not James's statements here are not blanket statements that concern every wealthy person who ever lived or ever will live. It's definitely not the case. These verses set the stage for his comments to those who are being oppressed, which is verses 7 and 8. Now, going back to the NIV, for those being oppressed by the wealthy, James says this, be patient then, brothers and sisters, until the Lord's coming. See how the farmer waits for the land to yield its valuable crop, patiently waiting for the autumn and spring rains? Well, you too, be patient and stand firm, because the Lord's coming is near. So what was James's advice to those Christians being oppressed by the rich? What are they to do? Well, they could act on God's behalf and bring his justice by force of arms if necessary. Or they could demonstrate outside their homes with placards and everything. They could take to social media and run down all these wealthy people. That's what would happen today. But James has already taught that human anger does not produce God's righteousness. Remember this, James 1, 19 and 20. My dear brothers and sisters, take note of this. Everyone should be, what? Quick to listen, slow to speak, and slow to become angry, because our anger does not produce the righteousness that God desires. Now, I know what some of you are thinking. Well, Jesus got angry in the temple. He overturned the money changers' tables. Yep, he did that. That was a righteous anger, though. Do you know the difference? If you don't know the difference between righteous anger and just human anger, then just avoid anger altogether until you've got it figured out. So instead of getting angry, these oppressed Christians, James says, are to be patient, or we might say endure patiently until the Lord returns. This is exactly the same virtue which is called perseverance. Back in the first chapter, where James writes this, James 1, 2, and 3, consider it pure joy, my brothers and sisters, whenever you face trials of many kinds, because you know that the testing of your faith produces perseverance. So basically, what James is telling his readers and us is to let that virtue of perseverance grow in us and mature us in our faith. Now, farmers, of course, possess this virtue in abundance. They have to. In Israel, they waited for the autumn rains before planting, and then they had to wait and hope that the spring rains would come and bring the grain to maturity before harvest. Christian waiting is kind of like that, but Christian waiting is not, I repeat, not waiting for something to happen, rather for someone. James has mentioned the Lord's coming already, and he talked about the judges standing at the door. The New Testament frequently refers to Christ's return as being near. But knowing he is coming should give Christians a sense of optimism when looking to the future. You should be anticipating the Lord's return, even while you go about living your life. And that should be a motivator for being patient, the implication here is that just be patient. The Lord is going to return, and he'll make everything right. The other implication, actually there's two implications. The other one is you'd better be patient because the Lord's coming back soon, and you don't want to be caught being angry or doing unseemly things to the wealthy people when the Lord returns. In both cases, James's point is the fact that the Lord will return soon or will return at any moment should be a motivating factor in living with patience. Now, in verses 9 to 12, James continues talking about persevering in the faith, but he picks up the theme of the tongue again, and he summarizes it. Now, he's already talked about the power of the tongue and how the tongue, you know, it's so difficult to tame, and it's a fire that no man can tame. It's set on fire by evil itself and all this. Well, he kind of comes back, as they say, circles back to the theme of the tongue. Just listen, James 5, 9 to 12. Don't grumble against one another, brothers and sisters, or you will be judged. The judge is standing at the door. In my Bible, there's an exclamation mark after that. This is a very strong point that James is making here. The implication is the judge is so close to returning. He's literally standing at your door, so you don't want him to hear you grumbling, do you? You don't want him to catch you grumbling, do you? So don't grumble. Brothers and sisters, as an example of patience in the face of suffering, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord. As you know, we count as blessed those who have persevered. You've heard of Job's perseverance and have seen what the Lord finally brought about. Well, the Lord is full of compassion and mercy. Above all, brothers and sisters, do not swear, not by heaven or by earth or by anything else. All you need to say is a simple yes or no, otherwise you'll be condemned. So, as we wait patiently for the Lord to return, we shouldn't, as James put it, grumble against each other. Now, it seems as though some form of infighting within the church was taking place. So James is addressing that in his letter. Now, there may be no infighting going on in your church or within your family, but this is still good advice. And it's going to come handy at some point in the future, because at some point in the future, you're going to be tempted to grumble against other members of your church, maybe against the pastor, or you're going to be tempted to grumble against people in your family or whatever. So this is good advice to just file away for future use. So James cautions the readers of this letter that such behavior put them in danger of being judged. James spoke of judgment in two ways here. First of all, the reality of judgment, but also the imminence of judgment. So those who engage in grumbling, complaining, whining against their brothers and sisters in the church are in very real danger of being judged by God for their sinful behavior. Oh, yes. Yes, this is definitely sinful behavior. And the possibility of that judgment for their unrepentant behavior is even more urgent, because the Lord's return is imminent, as in the Lord is standing at the door. That doesn't mean that the Lord is returning in the next 2 minutes. It does mean that the Lord's return will be quick. In other words, he'll be walking through the door very quickly, right? There's a difference between imminent and immediate. Imminent means that when the Lord returns, it's going to happen very fast indeed. Immediate means it's going to happen in the next second or two. That's not what James is saying here. So James gives an example of the kind of patience involved in holding our tongues. He talks about the prophets, brings them up. They suffered at the hands of the wealthy, of the kings. And the powerful. Yet while kings and such, like Ahab and Manasseh, for example, who persecuted prophets, they're forgotten or reviled. But the prophets they persecuted, like Isaiah and Elijah, are honored here on earth, and even more in heaven for that matter. The prophets, they never gave up in the face of opposition or persecution. They may have got discouraged for a little while, but they didn't stay there. They didn't wallow in it. Now, Job, he wasn't a prophet. He's also given as an example. And he's a funny example, too, because in truth, Job was not a very patient man, although Jewish lore presents him as such, and the readers of this letter would know those stories. So Job, I think, is mentioned not so much for his patience or lack of it, but because even though he suffered greatly, God didn't forget him, just as he's not forgotten the readers of this letter. And the reader then recites either Psalm 103, verse 8, or Psalm 111, verse 4, noting God's compassion and mercy. Psalm 103, verse 8, the Lord is compassionate and gracious, slow to anger, abounding in love. And Psalm 111, verse 4 says that God has caused his wonders to be remembered. The Lord is gracious and compassionate. So the point is that, look, God is not trying to make life hard for believers, but instead he's showing his mercy in assisting them to develop godlike character and to put their investments in heaven, where those investments will last forever. Now, James is going to go on to talk about the consequence of what would we say? Prayer and confession. The next topic in the conclusion of a Greek letter was normally to wish by the gods that the recipients would be in good health. But James does something even better. As he concludes his letter, he reminds the Christians of the provision God has made for their healing. So he's not wishing them well, he's telling them how to be well. This is not a new teaching to his readers, but a reminder of standard Christian practice. Let's read verses 13 to 18. Is anyone among you in trouble? Let them pray. Is anyone happy? Let them sing songs of praise. Is anyone among you sick? Let them call the elders of the church to pray over them and to anoint them with oil in the name of the Lord. And the prayer offered in faith will make them well. The Lord will raise them up. If they have sinned, they will be forgiven. Therefore, confess your sins to each other and pray for each other so that you may be healed. The prayer of a righteous person is powerful and effective. Elijah was a human being even as we are. He prayed earnestly that it would not rain, and it didn't rain on the land for 3.5 years. Again he prayed, and the heavens gave rain, and the earth produced its crops. The Christian community should be known by its prayer life. Is that how your church is known? Is your church known as a praying church? It ought to be. And these verses constitute a beautiful tribute to prayer in every circumstance, joyful or sorrowful. Like all Christian teachers, James divides the evil a person may experience into two categories. The first includes the term suffer and means those unpleasant experiences that come from the outside. Okay, you suffer from things happening outside, either the hardships experienced in spreading the gospel or some sort of a persecution or oppression by evil people. And these are what James has been discussing under the heading of tests or trials. So those suffering in this way should pray. Not necessarily for deliverance, but for the ability to endure patiently. I'd pray for both of those things. I pray, Lord, help, you know, please, if it be your will, deliver me from this particular, you know, persecution or hardship, but if not, help me to stay firm and to endure and persevere, sort of like the way our Lord prayed in the Garden of Gethsemane, right? Those who are having a good life at the moment, Maybe you're not suffering any kind of persecution. Well, that's great, but you should also pray. But their prayers should be songs of praise. And this leaves the second group of people experiencing evil, the sick. So what are the sick to do? Well, the sick are to call the elders of the church. Please note that. If you are sick, don't wait for the elders to call you. I've heard that my whole life in the ministry. The pastor never came over to pray for me. The pastor didn't know I was sick. Well, how could he know? He can't read your mind. It says right here, if you're sick, it's your responsibility to call the elders of the church. That's your job to reach out in faith. So when a person is so ill that he or she can't go to church, then they ought to want the people with the most faith in the church to come and pray for them. Normally, that would be the elders, like the pastor and the elders. And normally, when the illness is not major, the rule is to pray for one another. So if you're sick, don't automatically assume that the pastor knows you're sick. He's got many things to do in his church. He's got to write sermons. He's got to prepare Bible studies. He's got people coming to see him in church, so on and so forth. Call him up. Say, hey, I'm sick. Haven't you noticed I haven't been at church for 2 weeks? You ought to come here and pray for me. I'll guarantee you the pastor will be banging on your door before you hang up your phone. The elders will act just like the disciples did in Mark chapter 6, verse 13. They drove out many demons and anointed many sick people with oil and healed them. That's what we do. But you have to reach out in faith, believing that's what will happen. They were to not only pray for the ill person, but to anoint them with oil as they pray, so that, get this, their prayer is not only heard, but physically felt. Now, there is something very special about the human touch. A lot of Christians have known that forever, but apparently most other people didn't, but they learned it over the years of the scamdemic, where where a lot of people were afraid to go near other people for fear that they'd catch the Wuhan Red Death. And we suffered because of that. Touch is very, very important. So pray for them and touch them. Anoint them with oil. Also, another reason to anoint a sick person with oil in James's day was because oil was seen as like medication. So what James is saying here also is pray, have someone pray for you that you'll recover, but then take your medication at the same time. The important thing here is that the prayer is to the Lord and the anointing is done in the Lord's name. So it's the Lord. It's not the power of the prayer or the power of the oil or the power of the medication who will raise up the sick person. It's the Lord. The Lord works through prayer. The Lord works through medication. Oral Roberts used to say that no man can heal another man, that all healing comes from the Lord. And I absolutely believe that. And this is how James promises that the Lord will respond to the prayer offered in faith. This is not a hope so or a maybe prayer, but a prayer which shows secure confidence that God will heal, because the elders have first listened to God and have received this confidence in their hearts. It's very close, I think, to Paul's gift of faith that he talked about. He talked about that in, let me look it up because I was just reading about it. 1 Corinthians 12:9, that's right. To another faith by the same Spirit, to another gifts of healing by that one Spirit. So the gift of faith is a gift of the Spirit, as is the gift of healing. So these kinds of prayers take time. They're not a quick ritual prayer or routine. Yeah, that's true. I mean, you know, in my church, we always have what we call joys and concerns, where the congregation is invited to share with everybody what the Lord has done for them in the past week. Has he answered a prayer? Has he done something good for you, you know? And we also take prayer requests. And I promise you that when I lead in prayer, and I pray, you know, for prayer requests, it's usually for, you know, somebody with cancer, or they're sick, or they've got having heart disease or something. That's not how I pray for a person in person. It's totally different. Like when you're praying in public, it's kind of like a general prayer that you use. But when I'm meeting with somebody in their sick bed or in the hospital, it's a different way of praying altogether, right? So sometimes you have to take time when you're praying for an ill person. Now, James discusses the connection that sometimes, not always, but sometimes sickness and sin are connected. Okay, not all sickness has to do with sin. And God knows the difference. John 9, verses 1 to 3, listen to this. As he went along, as Jesus went along, he saw a man blind from birth. Remember the story? His disciples asked him, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" Look at what Jesus said. "Neither this man nor his parents sinned, but this happened so that the works of God might be displayed in him." So the Lord knows the difference. He knows that if somebody's sin was caused by their sickness, or somebody's sickness was caused by their sin or not. But at the same time, you know, sin can cause sickness. 1 Corinthians 11, 28 to 30, Paul says, "Everyone ought to examine themselves before they eat of the bread and drink of the cup. For those who eat and drink without discerning the body and blood of Christ, eat and drink judgment on themselves. That's why many among you are weary and sick, and a number of you have fallen asleep." They've died. Well, that's a terrible thing. Imagine if in our churches today, people died because they had communion and their hearts weren't right. Wouldn't that be something? I think our churches would be empty. So if sin is involved in this sick person's illness, then this root needs to be dealt with before moving on to the fruit of the root, the sickness itself. So James assures us that these sins will be forgiven. God will not withhold forgiveness to prolong the illness. In fact, James argues that it would be better to take care of the sin before it causes severe illness. He says, "Confess your sin one to another. Make sure that you guys, you elders and you pastors who are praying, make sure that you have no unconfessed sin in your life too. No elder is needed for this, as each believer is a priest in God's eyes." So I would suggest that, as you are praying for somebody, maybe it's the pastor and he's brought a couple of elders with him. When you pray, begin by asking the Lord to forgive you if there's sin in your life, unconfessed sin. Get that out of the way before you pray. There's great value in confessing sin out loud and receiving from another believer the assurance that it's forgiven. I don't think that James means that you need to list them all. My Lord, that could take all day in some cases. The sick person could die before you're finished confessing your sin. But don't be so hoity-toity that you assume you have no unconfessed sin in your life, Reverend. Because you do, just like I do. So before you get down to the serious business of praying for someone else's need, make sure that you take care of the unconfessed sin in your own life. It may be that a reader of this letter will say something like, "Well, that's fine for elders, but I'm just a regular, ordinary Christian. How can I pray for anyone's healings? You know, how can I hear their confessions?" Yet, as believers, we are righteous. So our prayers are powerful and effective. Elijah, James notes, was an ordinary guy, just like all believers. But he had an extraordinary God, like you do. This extraordinary God is the one who hears and answers prayer. I can't heal anybody. You can't heal anybody. God does. God honors the faith of those who pray and those who are prayed over or prayed for. Now, James's final exhortation here as we wrap up this study and as we wrap up this series of studies is not accidentally chosen. James 5, 19 and 20. My brothers and sisters, if one of you should wander from the truth and someone should bring them back, remember this. Whoever turns a sinner from the way of evil will save them from death and cover over a multitude of sins. Isn't that beautiful? The church is made up of people who should be living by the word of truth. If you are a Christian, I hope that you are living your life, planning your life around the teachings of Scripture. And I hope that you have received with humility the implanted word that is within you. We must all work together in ensuring that our churches and our lives, for that matter, run smoothly by applying the teachings that James has in his letter. If you are living by the word of truth, and if you have received the word with humility, those things work together against individual and communal self-deception and deviation. That is to say, those things will keep you as an individual on the straight and narrow, and they will keep your church on the straight and narrow. Mutual correction and exhortation are therefore expressions of love. In other words, as members of the church, we are to watch out for one another. And if you see a brother or sister beginning to wander from the Lord, it is your duty, it is your obligation to, in love, talk to them about that. And the same thing goes for you. If you are wandering from the Lord you're getting involved in something that you shouldn't be involved in, and a member of the church confronts you about it, then you have to receive that correction with love. And all things being equal, you will. And that correction will be given in love. And that goes for the pastor too. And I tell the members of my congregation, if you see me doing something that's not right, don't gossip about me. Confront me about it. Tell me, hey, what are you doing? That was not the right thing to say. Or you didn't speak that in love. Or whatever I've done that you perceive as being wrong. So in that way, the church can run smoothly and everything stays out in the open. At the end, James exhorts all his readers to do for each other what he has been trying to do for them. Yep. And that, my friends, is our survey of James's letter. Now, next Monday, 100% guaranteed, we're going to start our in-depth study of the book of James. For the past 5 weeks, we have kind of brushed against the major themes that James covers in his letter. Starting next Monday, we're going to go right back to chapter 1 and go in depth and plumb the depths of the wisdom that James offers us in the 5 chapters of his letter. Come on back on Wednesday, day after tomorrow, for another Bible study. I think we're going to be looking at the next phrase in the Lord's Prayer, the model prayer. And we'll see you then. It's about 35 minutes past the hour, gone a little overtime. Have a great day today. Thank you so much for listening. We'll see you again the day after tomorrow, Lord willing, and he delays his return. God bless.